KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm excited to have on the show someone who's been in the technology and particularly internet space for pretty much as long as it's been around, at least to public knowledge. Paul Jones of University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and also of the well-known site iBiblio. Paul is joining us today by Skype from his office at Chapel Hill, and we are going to be having a wide-ranging discussion with one of the real internet pioneers and someone who has been around long enough to be able to talk to us about the history of the internet from personal experience, as well as talk about where it is today, as Paul continues to be a very active scholar and almost, and it's probably a cliche to say, Renaissance man, because among other things, Paul is also a poet. Paul is someone also who has a lot of interesting ideas and theories with respect to how social media is used. So one of our topics today of discussion is going to be a course that he taught at Chapel Hill, I believe this past semester, where all of the readings were new media. By that particularly, we're speaking of things like YouTube videos. So we're going to talk about that course and how that went, as well as other, I think, very interesting topics, including information scarcity, as well as the broad areas of privacy, publicity, secrecy, and transparency. Now, obviously, we are not going to cover everything in those areas. We could probably spend the next several years talking, and I think Paul has other things he has to do today. But that particular broad topic is part of Paul's thinking with regard to a piece and contribution he'll be making to a law review symposium at Elon University Law School in the fall. In addition, we are going to discuss iBiblio for those that are not familiar with iBiblio and where it is today. So I'm very excited to have Paul on, one of the real leading minds in technology and someone that I've wanted to talk to for quite a while, and someone whose work I knew prior to planting my flag here in North Carolina. By way of very brief background, Paul is the director of iBiblio, a project that includes a site formerly known as MetaLab and SunSite, and those names, for anyone that knows the history of the internet, should ring a bell. These are really the early internet websites that really were precursors to where we are today. He speaks widely and also is an active writer, as I mentioned, not only of poetry, but of technology-related work. He's on the board of a variety of technology organizations, including the American Open Technology Consortium, and local organizations in North Carolina, like the Chapel Hill Public Library. So this is someone who has a lot to say, and without any further introduction, let's have Paul say it. Paul, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture and taking the time.
Well, thanks a lot for having me here, David. I've enjoyed listening to your show since early on, and you've had some great people, and you always ask impossible questions, so I'm looking forward to what impossibilities you'll bring forward.
Paul, what is the nature of man? No, I'm kidding. I'll take a step back and hopefully ask some questions more manageable.
The nature of man is to suffer and die.
Well, that may very well be. I will. Yes, I have made it a specialty to ask impossible questions, and usually I ask those questions with 10 minutes or so left in the show. So I'll do my best to avoid that conflict as well. Paul, for many people, I'm sure, familiar with technology are going to know your name, but for those that are not familiar, perhaps you can talk a little bit more about your background and how you became interested in the issues that we're going to be discussing today.
Well, that could be a long story because I got my computer science degree in 1972, entering at NC State in 68. So it's one of the first undergraduate computer science programs in the country. I got into it really because I couldn't learn a foreign language, but I was interested in, oddly enough, this is something college professors should think about. When I was a freshman, I was admitted to NC State in engineering because I could never learn Spanish. The short part is I went to the psychology department because I'd heard of something called cybernetics. I was interested in the machine and human interactions. Really helped. It struck me that computers weren't really just about number crunching or engineering issues, but they were ways in which eventually there would be some ways that humans could interact or they would be enhanced or that something would happen. And nobody really could talk much about that in computer science. I mean, in psychology, as it turns out, they sent me to a guy who went, well, nobody knows what this is. And I went to computer science and they said, well, we don't know, but we think we're going to work in that area pretty soon. And there weren't really network computers much at that point. It was all connected by telephone lines, low speed. My background was already more in literature as well as math and science. So bringing them together and keeping those parts together has always been important to me. So I made my money being a computer person. I wrote and helped found the North Carolina Writers Network because the social part of helping people help themselves and helping people cooperatively build organizations to help each other has really been what we're about. And iBiblio itself is pretty much that way, starting with free software, but not limiting ourselves to free software. So what I like to tell people is that iBiblio has its roots in free software, but almost immediately we looked for collaborative and individual projects that, like the software, drew on eccentric and sometimes unique organizational structures.
Now, and I should point out that we're recording this show actually on July 9th. For those people that are keeping track, so we'll be airing a show a little bit later in the month. To talk a little bit more about iBiblio, which is good introductory material before we get into some other issues. Why would one a consumer or an individual surfing the net go to iBiblio? Who is that person?
Well, that. People who go to any website go there because Google gave it to them. Or a friend referred it, more recently, friends referred it to something there randomly on Facebook or on Twitter.
Right.
So, and that's a change we've just seen really in the last year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
iBiblio is very famous among software developers because we're one of the largest distributors are mirrors for Linux and free software. However, we have about 2,500 collections that are non-software related. So ones you've heard of, and just to name four that have fit in different sectors, Project Gutenberg, which is the largest non-out-of-copyright collaboratively produced text archive. And mm-hmm. So it's the entire history of the world pre-1920X, depending on the year, are there. And that's a project that started very, very early in the 90s by Michael Hart. And we're the reference site for that. That one's an interesting one for various reasons of how they do collaboration and how that work is produced, as well as the content. Another one is one of the largest free music sites called eTree.org. eTree is based on tape trading trees, and it's it's populated by music by bands that allow live taping from the board of their shows, pioneered largely by Grateful Dead and Grateful Dead spinoffs, but also other bands that come out of that organ. So there's several hundred bands that allow live, high-quality live recordings of their shows. And it tends to be more jam bands, but not exclusively that.
Are there any, the Grateful Dead, as you mentioned, made a name for doing this. Are there other bands that you think are well-known bands that are part of this group?
So, yeah, String Cheese. Basically, anybody who's a jam band follows the Dead tradition.
Right.
So, you know, it can be String Cheese Incident. Right. It can, to some degree, at some times, be Dave Matthews.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's right, yeah.
He has different moments. As an album is about to come out or just come out, he blacks out.
Uh-huh.
Or you know, you're not supposed to do it. Or they'll just ask you not to.
Right.
Same thing with Bella Fleck and others. So, and some bands are, you know, happy for these recordings to just become public in the sense that it creates, you know, a sort of market, a sort of interest, and a sort of trade.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about these guys is MP3 is too low a quality for live recording outdoors of the Grateful Dead and whatever state band members are in. But you want perfect quality, and so they're either in shortened or FLAC mm-hmm. formats mm-hmm. there. And it's a tremendous self-policed group. And also the metadata, just to get a little geeky here.
Sure.
These guys enforce a very high level of quality of metadata, not just about the content, but about the conditions of recording and the connectors and all the equipment arranged and like that. So that kind of collaborative thing is sort of a precursor to the folksonomies that people like Thomas Vanderwall talk about that we saw appearing in Flickr or other places. But these guys were already doing that in a lot of ways just so because they demanded it of each other.
So this is serious. This is serious jamming. This is not the old days of just happening to know the guy running the board and sticking something in there to record it.
Well, you could know that, but you need to tell more. So these guys are there. Then those of you who are interested in intellectual property law and technology, Grok Law is hosted here, and you know Grok Law is a lot about IP. Exclusively about IP and open technologies. And Pamela Jones runs that. That's pretty much run, you know, as a wide-ranging and very active legal discussion to just talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the past almost 15 years, we have one guy who has every month recorded a different American folk song and released it for free download. So now he's up to well over 150 songs. And he had a band in the 1960s that made a lot of money by adding rock beats to folk songs, basically. He invented folk rock, a band called The Byrds.
Mm-hmm.
So Roger McGuinn has about 160, almost 175 songs for free download and listing on a non-commercial basis.
Well, that's something. And, you know, this. Of course, you understate it. But I mean, the Byrds are one of the seminal bands of that era, and Roger McGuinn was their spiritual as well as creative leader, as far as I could tell. So that's quite something. Just out of curiosity, is Roger based in North Carolina? So that he's doing this.
Or? None of the places that we mentioned have anything to do with the state of North Carolina.
So
at least they're not here.
At least they're not here. Fair enough.
So Roger lives in Florida.
Very good. Now,
but he also is on the road.
That's okay. Along the lines of iBiblio, as I mentioned in the introduction, I mean, the iBiblio comes out of your work with Sunsight. And in fact, you wrote a book on web servers in 1995. Which probably, I mean, I would imagine it may have been the first, but certainly was one of the first books along those lines. In terms of putting yourself back in that mindset in 1995 and writing a book about web servers, what were you seeing at that point was going to be the use or the need for a book like that versus where we are today?
Well, we thought, of course, that everybody would run their own server and that if we just gave them the tools, they would do that. So one of the innovations of that book is it came with a ready-made CD that would install Linux. And the web server along with it. So I think the first one was Slackware, and then the guys who were doing Red Hat, I think we may have at one point actually shipped it with Red Hat, a very, very early version of Red Hat.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a push-button install of, so your computer could be upgraded from Windows to Linux and have a web server installed, because don't forget, Windows at that time could not run a server, really. And our idea was that with our book, you could probably become a self-publisher. The original Tim Berners-Lee idea was everybody would run a web server, everybody would leave their computers on all the time, everybody would be sharing information, everybody would be collaboratively editing. So a lot of those things, of course, didn't happen. You had it become more of a publishing platform for a short period of time. And now with blogs and with comments and with Twitter and with Facebook, or even things that are walled gardens like Facebook, they're more moved to the sort of Henry Jenkins idea of participatory culture. Mm-hmm. People taking to whatever degree something and making something. And so the web server book was done, one, so we could get paid for the work we were doing, because we had a unique opportunity. We were, I think, Bebo White at Stanford set up the first server in North America, but we followed him fairly closely with a server at a project that was funded by Sun Microsystems called SunSight.
The guest is Paul Jones of iBiblio, among other, and UNC Chapel Hill, among other affiliations. Paul, as we think about, and actually I think this is kind of a good transition, like I said, we have a variety of topics to cover, and I don't want to cover each one sporadically, but I do want to ask you this. We are, as I mentioned, we're chatting by Skype, and as you mentioned, I think it's a good innovation that I haven't spent much time really thinking about, but we're also able to see each other by way of video, which does give the effect of an in-studio recording and is helpful. You taught a course, as I mentioned in the introduction, this past semester, where video was the primary source of information, and those were the readings. Can you talk a little bit about, what that course was about?
Okay, so this was a course that started based on some conversations that I'd had with Howard Rheingold. And we were talking about the idea that, and also with Dan Gilmore, that everybody now had a video recording device that would fit in their pocket. And that in journalism, we weren't really using or thinking about that. We were very, very good at doing broadcast journalism, but not very good at doing informal with video, but not very good at thinking about or using vernacular video, just informal video. Yet we saw YouTube being used by Americans for larger amounts of time than broadcast television. Mm-hmm. This happened in the last year and a half. So I taught for about 8 years a course on virtual communities, which varied depending on the number of undergraduates versus graduates in the course. So sometimes it was about a lot of theory of community and a lot of social capital studies, and sometimes it was more a survey of contrast and compare ideas of virtual communities or networked individuals. So this course was called Vernacular Video. I added Vernacular Video to the title, and I made video an essential part. So what I did, I replaced all readings with videos. Mm-hmm. Now, the videos are all available for free on YouTube or somewhere else on the net. Many of them talks given at TED, say at TED.org. Mm-hmm. So, and they're talks given by the same authors that I would have assigned my students to read a book or a paper by. But I wanted them to have the immediacy and some sort of access to the personality behind the research, to put a face on it, as we say in journalism. Not just an academic paper or a popular book, but a dynamic presentation of those ideas in about a 45 to 90 minute format. So, and then the other problem that I had, and you may not have recognized this, is, undergrads, I'm sure this is different in law school, but they don't always read their assignments. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a lot of competition for what they want to do. So, and one of the things that I hate doing in class as a professor is to try to figure out who's done the readings and who hasn't. And to try to figure out by usually by striking fear in the hearts of those that don't, how to change their behavior. So what I had these students do is watch the videos online outside of class on their own time and respond to those videos with videos of their own. And it could be just as we're doing now, captured directly off of your computer in the webcam or off their phone, produced if they wanted to produce it, using animation tools if they wanted to use animation. But the idea was I would have 20 two-minute videos, each of them talking about what they saw. So this was a good way to get compliance, but also a way for me. It was required to be submitted 8 hours before class, so I could watch all these. And I could then draw on these people in the seminar, making the seminar dynamic and more expansive based on the ideas that went on there. Then, using Skype, I invited several of the speakers to visit the class.
And it's an innovative teaching strategy, and as you mentioned, I think it would be a significant challenge. In fact, I don't think it would be possible to do in a first-year law course, but perhaps in a seminar.
Absolutely. It's much more a seminar format.
Yeah. I'm not aware of judges or anyone, in fact, doing renderings of court decisions in a way that would allow me to say, rather than read Smith v. Jones, why don't you listen to Harrison Ford read it to you?
Might be stuck with court TV.
That's right. Which I might be able to
Judge Judy.
Exactly. Yeah, you might be able to build a course around that. So along those lines, along the pedagogical line, I should say, what did you find with regard to the students' capture and understanding and retention, to the extent you could measure it, of information by video versus the traditional reading? Do you have any? And again, I know this is the first time you taught it, but do you have any rudimentary sense of how that went?
Well, really, I'm looking for engagement. Mm-hmm. So in this course, I'm not taking back our information and placing it in the brains of students. Mm-hmm. I want them to remake and recontextualize, personalize, and make connections of the material that they've learned. So this is very cross-disciplinary in that we had sociologists like Barry Wellman. We had viewings of anthropologists like Robin Dunbar. We had a visitor, in the case that we had Howard Rheingold, of course, and Dan Gilmore, visit by Skype. We had Ted Turner, who's written this book, Counterculture to Cyberculture, mm-hmm. Visit and talk to the class. And this is a journalism class, so Ted and Dan are particularly good there, having been journalists. And I wanted this to be lively and engaging. And we're talking about seniors in journalism, people who've already got the basics down, who really need windows into areas that they haven't looked into themselves, and to synthesize that material and to use critical thinking and critical approaches to make it into something bigger in discussion with the group. So we're talking about a live seminar here, not a basic entry course. Mm-hmm. And although I would argue that to a certain degree, basic entry courses could be enhanced by that, the same thing. You learn a lot in doing this, and one accidental thing that I learned is I thought the video would be a new format that would excite students, a way to put a face on it and make it lively. Speak to them in a way in which they might synthesize the information in a different way. But I did realize something very, very different. And one of the first 90-minute video that I had them watch, one of my better students came up to me and said, "Do you know how long this video is?" And I went, "Yeah, it says right on it, 90 minutes. And she went, I never spend 90 minutes on any course. And I went, well, that's weird because I think I'm assigning you 2 to 3 hours a night because this is a 3-hour course. You know, each class meeting should take about that amount of prep. And she went, oh, no, that's not how we see it. And I realized that there's a complete disjuncture between what we as faculty members think is a reasonable amount of time to spend on work and how much an undergraduate will spend. And this was brought to a point really by something really simple, a timestamp on the video.
Yeah.
And so I had greater compliance. She did it. She produced the work. She asked intelligent questions. She whined a little bit, but that was all fine. And altogether, I learned something about how to think about what my assignments are with my students that were candid and surprisingly so.
Do you anticipate teaching a course in this format again?
Well, this fall I'll be doing one for honor students or named scholars at UNC, and it will be not entirely that way because to be counted on is I'll have some freshmen in it and some other stuff, and there's a writing requirement. They have to somehow write 10 pages of text at some point. But we are going to have video in it also, and we are already going to have some visitors, some of them the same and some different, to talk about the cultures of social networking, not the software of social networking so much, but how people create cultures within it.
You posted a video describing the course appropriately on YouTube, and therefore it is publicly accessible. I watched that video, and one thing I noticed that I wanted to ask you about was you moved around a lot. You moved your head forward and backwards, and then there were profile shots and whatever. And I was just curious why.
Have you ever seen Zay Frank's videos?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so mine was a sort of slow-mo version of Zay Frank, really.
Fair
One
enough.
Of the things I really liked about what Zay does is he does all these sharp jump cuts to all different ways that his head is. And I went, you know, if I could do this, because if you have a talking head there, what people do is just like run the audio in the background. And so you could still do this with this intro.
Right.
But I also wanted to make it look a little different for those students in a very low-tech kind of way.
Right.
You know, that they could do without having to learn anything other than stop and start.
Right. Yeah, and I think from the very simple point that it kept me looking at the screen to see what angle was going to appear next. In my younger days when I first got my hands on a video camera, I amused myself by filming family events where I would just rotate the camera 360 degrees and a person would just start, you know, being upside down or whatever else. So perhaps it's just brought back very deep memories
right.
of my childhood. But I, it was the same
idea. I was worried that students who had come out of a really good studio video class would be afraid to play around with it.
Right,
so
right.
for it to be vernacular, just like you, just as you did at your family gathering, is I wanted to create that sort of sense of informality and play that said, well, if this guy will do this, then I can probably, do it with one guy did it only as if he were in the witness protection program, like he had bright lights behind him and he was nothing but a black profile the entire semester.
Right.
For example. And that was fine. And nobody even really commented on it that much. You know, they just, oh, yeah, that's him.
And that worked.
Part of that vernacularity, sort of that commonness.
Mm-hmm. We are chatting with Paul Jones of iBiblio and UNC Chapel Hill on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that are familiar with Hearsay Culture and with KZSU, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can click on donate, at kzsu.stanford.edu, the website. Either way, you will get a response, and I hope you continue listening to the station. You know, Paul, KZSU, I believe, was one of the first college radio stations, or maybe even one of the first stations, I'm not sure, to actually stream audio. And in fact, I probably, if I'm wrong about this, or if I've understated it, am I wrong that we're one of the first?
You may be one of the first.
But not the first.
We were the first. And there you know that. You're pulling my chain. So, and Wikipedia has it right. At last I looked.
Newman.
WXYC here in Chapel Hill was the first continuous streaming radio station, and the first. In fact, we would have been about possibly 5 or 6 months earlier than we were, but we were afraid to announce it until we got some legal stuff cleared out.
Yeah.
So that should be interesting to you. In fact, the way we did get around the potential legal issues is there is, as you know, in college radio stations, if you're in the X format, mm-hmm. WXYC here being the station, there is a couple of paragraphs about experimental techniques that you could use,
mm-hmm.
that college radio stations should look at experimental techniques. It was really aimed at carrier current stations, which are stations that run on the power lines instead of the antenna. And so when you could run like a dorm
right.
radio station, if you plugged in your radio, it would pick up that stuff off carrier current. And we used that as our model to talk to the communications lawyers and said, well, the internet is just carrier current, just like that.
right.
And that was a pretty good argument for couple of years.
Yeah, I was about to say, unfortunately, it didn't survive. That argument, I mean.
Yeah, I think it should be seen as a carrier current station, and particular to college stations.
Right. Well, notwithstanding the factual inaccuracy, I'm proud to say that KZSU at least was one of the early actors.
We're glad that you could look to WXYC and model yourselves on that.
There you go. And for listeners that want to see how college radio fights begin, this is usually how they are. So it's good for some yucks. Paul, let's turn to some of the interesting work that you're doing. One of the points that you've been thinking about, and something that we've chatted about a little bit, and we can expand on here, is a shift, as you put it, from a cultures of information abundance from information scarcity. This is a topic that I've discussed with several guests on Hearsay Culture, and I want to get your views on it without coloring them in any way by mentioning any names or anything else. What are you concerned about with regard to that shift?
Okay, so what we've seen recently is two polarities of looking at that. That is Nicholas Carr versus Clay Shirky, mm-hmm. and we've seen that play out in newspapers. I think the best evaluation or critique of these is that Carr is very, very concerned about what happens at an individual level first. How does an individual who has grown up in scarcity deal with issues of abundance? Whereas Shirky is concerned about how will whole societies change moving towards abundance. And away from security. In other words, a kind of rich moment, like a green revolution of information, like a sort of post-penicillin era of health, And I think those are massive personal transportation as opposed to massive ubiquitous personal transportation as opposed to barely functional, say, mass transit.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we see happening is changes in information law. Copyright was meant to be a way, for example, to move things out and distribute because you'd have this, you know, creative incentive. You would also have a distribution incentive. We don't talk about that part. We also talk about the incentive being given to the author so that she will create. But the real money doesn't come from creating. The real money comes from dissemination. And so in copyright, the law actually, as fact, rewards that part. But what we've seen with collaborative constructions, Linux software, or any of the other, the way that Gutenberg has worked, or the way that E-Tree has worked for bands and creating audience, we've seen that you can get money other ways. You know, that it's particularly possible to do this, and you can reach audiences that you couldn't reach before. So our challenge is not is being faced part in information products, but it also has to do with the other issue that you leaned towards early. How much personal publicity do we have to do in this world? What does oversharing mean? What is really secret? How do we create reputation in that kind of world? Those are ways that were often mediated more heavily now and that you can actually do for yourself. So, for example, you didn't call me up and ask me about my biography and then check two or three references to find out about me. You just went on the web and hit Google, and luckily there are enough Paul Joneses, so I'm pseudo-anonymous slightly. But you can find out a lot about me, just as, you know, you probably have a collection of David Levine's and I have a collection of Paul Joneses.
That's right.
Too, we're high in non-uniqueness, but other people can create the, and so with an abundance of Paul Joneses and David Levine's, we have to really work on our publicity and, to some extent, our reputation.
Right.
Because if the bad Paul Joneses or the bad David Levine's aren't doing us any good. So this management of who you are was not really kind of a problem before, you know, there, unless you were like David Levine or Paul Jones.
Right.
Most people went through life being moderately unique.
Right.
With their reputation and with their stuff. Now that there's an information abundance, we often talk about the copyright part, the access part, but and how do I deal with all this stuff sort of dumping on me? You know, am I having information overload? And if you look back, frankly, there are information overloads books going back to the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's, you know, wringing their hands about it, you know, every 5 or 10 years. But sometimes it's the phone rings too much if you're Lucy. I love Lucy.
Right. But
to me, the interesting thing that we're facing is how reputation, privacy, secrecy, and publicity all interact. I don't have any answer for these, but to me, the way I see law reacting is law is still reacting in a sort of sense of scarcity about that. You know, it's sort of, well, you should just be able to take care of it, or how slander really and libel are kind of narrowed in a way. It's also an interference that happens because casual slander and libel are generally aimed towards a sort of more formal presentation of speech and personality, for example. And what we see online is very, very informal stuff. Like, people aren't going after slander if you say something bad in a bar confrontation with somebody necessarily. But if you said it on a newspaper forum in discussion with someone, I mean, somebody could go after that. And there are consequences that are there, and we are constantly trying to remind our teenagers how the privacy settings work on Facebook, for example. But we do know how teenagers will respond. We know that they were very casual about managing their privacy until about 18 months ago, and something happened that changed teens' behavior on Facebook in regards to privacy that no amount of warning could make happen. That is a giant migration of women over 45 onto Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if you watch that demographic come in and you're watching the privacy settings, they were going in like mad. Because your mom or your grandmother or your aunt, you will turn on those things for them. No lecture will do it, but as soon as your mom replies in all types to your wall.
Right.
All caps to your wall. You're going to change that behavior. So we learned a lot about teenagers quickly there. The best way to modify their behavior is to allow their mother in the virtual room. And then they kind of take care of business. But we also learned something about our assumptions about how the people were using the social network of Facebook, which is originally Keep Connected for teens and preteens and emerging adults to keep in touch with with relationships that were casual but might drop away. Somebody who was in your class this semester, you like them, but they're not in your class the next semester. You just don't see them.
Right.
Or you take it. So we know that that's one way it was managed. When we watched these women come in, it wasn't about keeping recent connections alive, but it was about reconnecting across time. And we saw some technology responses to that too, because they were more pictures. There's a big change. People used to upload pictures to Flickr, and now there's a tremendous surge of picture uploads to Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And Facebook was really smart about this. This is people, you could see people complaining about learning to upload pictures. If you think about it, there was a giant change and a really more easier interface for uploading large amounts of picture to Facebook that was implemented about a year ago or so, just right on the crest of this wave of picture uploads, but largely driven by women over 45.
We're chatting with Paul Jones of iBiblio and UNC Chapel Hill on Hearsay Culture. Paul, you know, I know that this is a topic that you'll be discussing at Elon for the Law Review Symposium in the fall, and so we're in the formative stages. There's quite a bit of writing, and I know you're familiar with the literature regarding the physiology, if you will, of a child or teenager's brain. We had a slight audio malfunction on our end here, but we're back with Paul Jones. So, Paul, I was asking you about Gary Small's work with regard to the physiology, really, of a teenager's brain and the child's ability to deal with the onslaught of media that currently exists. What's your reaction to his work?
Well, first, I have to say that I'm not a brain researcher, and Small is, although specializing in aging. He runs an aging center. And I do think that our immediate reaction to understanding brain plasticity is sort of a panic. There's a panic reaction and a hope reaction, just as there is with information technology. And I do think that the idea that there's a certain kind of normality in reading is not just under challenge, but the prevalence of varieties of dyslexia and other ways that the brain we now know that the brain remaps to cope with different problems. It makes things a little bit different. And I think Small is held up a lot because he said, oh, your brain is different, but nobody knows what the difference means, really. And Stanislav Dehaene has a book called Reading the Brain, The Science and Evolution of a Human Invention, that really looks at what reading does to form the brain. It may be that what we're seeing on the internet is more like what our brain was built to do, and that reading is a very, very artificial construct that maps the brain in its own completely odd way. So Dehaene is interested a lot in his book about mapping and seeing how dyslexic brains look, how they are after being trained to read more efficiently. So we're going to see more work like this coming out because we're right at the edge of it. We do know that functional MRI is telling us something, just as we know from early DNA research that gene expression was telling us something, but we're not sure quite what. We know that certain parts of the brain, of certain people's brains, get hot or have more blood flow when doing certain activities. We don't know to what extent there's background noise from the measurement, and we don't know to what extent seeing other things going on in the brain mean yet, or how permanent remapping is. Although Small, in his book, iBrain, does say that once we learn something, we change to a certain extent, as does Dehaene, looking at the dyslexic brain slightly being changed. So there is a whole idea of, you know, what reading means, what number sense means, what reading on the internet looks like, what attention means. All of these are under challenge in abundance and in a new format. I keep wondering, as I read Small, what would happen if we did functional MRIs of early people who had never used the telephone, measuring them in conversation and then measuring them with the telephone, for example. Because we know that when you're coping with something new, your brain fires in different ways. That part we at least know. Where it fires is yet to be yet to be really completely understood.
We're chatting.
We know something's happening.
We're chatting with Paul Jones on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Yeah, that something happening is in one sense exhilarating, in another sense a little concerning. Do you think we're asking? I mean, in your view, and you know, especially considering where the internet has come from and its uses, do you think we're asking ultimately, in your view, too much of children with this technology? Or on the other hand, is this exactly what can really amplify and enrich a teenager's life?
Well, what we do see, this is really where Dana Boyd and Fred Stutzman's work is very important. Fred's focusing mostly on emerging adults using Facebook largely, and Dana's work coming out of early users in MySpace, but not in any way restricted to that. So now, to put a value judgment on what's the matter with kids today versus the kids are all right sort of argument, we don't know. We do see that the early stuff that's coming out from the Pew studies is that the kids are more social. They tend to be more collaborative. They tend to be able to create temporary, I don't want to say temporary autonomous zones to get too much there, but really areas of temporary cooperation for groups to get certain tasks done. They're able to, and the cost of that is that perhaps there's less of a certain kind of individual expression, but it also reflects how he asks people to work in the world. You know, that you're often doing ad hoc creative teams in which you learn certain skills together, or you bring together people that have certain skills to create things, and the internet is very good for that. I think that they're also learning different ways to manage who they are, not and their performance of self that's out there, something that's different from what we've experienced, but even people who are my age are having experience that was very different from our parents. If nothing else, that we had a level of mobility that our parents never saw. And I meant actual physical mobility, getting from place to place. You know, that we were driving to a greater distance, we were taking road trips, those kind of things.
Paul, in our remaining few minutes, this is, as you mentioned, I ask unfair and impossible questions from time to time. I don't think this one is too unfair or impossible, even in the time we have left. In terms of things you're working on now, and where we're headed, this question really is one aimed for the audience's benefit, particularly people who are researchers and write on technology. If there's an area that you think needs to be delved into more deeply, and I'm not talking about theoretically, but even practical levels as well, are there any areas that you think or you would call upon the scholarly community to focus on at this point?
Well, I think one that law and sociology and others will begin to focus on, and I think is more important, is this concept that really comes from Robin Dunbar in anthropology, and he edited a book called Grooming Gossip and the Evolution of Language. I'm not really concerned as much, and what I'm putting forward, with the evolution of language, but the importance of casual conversation, of consequential strangers, as Melinda Belaw hit his book, as the fabric of a community, both online and off, how it's enhanced by our mobility, by our access to mobile communications, and by our access to this abundance of information. All right. That has a big influence on law, which has, you know, works on precedent, and as you have precedents changing, there has to be some grappling. It has to do with our social contracts. It has to do with how news and reporting is done, how much stuff should be considered just sort of none your business and just kind of gossip or kind of casual, and how much of it is serious, heavy looks into the brains and behaviors. How much self-censorship we'll do now that we're more public with a lot of what we're doing, and how much we will forgive certain information behaviors.
Paul Jones of iBiblio, as well as UNC Chapel Hill, thanks for joining us today on the show. I'm really excited to have had you on, and I definitely invite you back. For those people that want to learn more about you and your work, where can you point them?
Well, the best place to see all of what we're up to is iBiblio.org, and I hope that when you explore there, you'll see that things change a lot over time, that we're adding new collections and new insights by new interesting people and new interesting groups collaboratively working together. I think you'll find a lot of surprises there, either by accident through Google or by intentionality, by going to iBiblio.org and seeing what goes on there. That's probably the easiest access as far as publications coming out. Let me just, for a little wacky and casual stuff, tell you where the next three places that I have just recently appeared or will appear in print. None of them academic exactly. One is in Skirt magazine, which features, it's really aimed at young professional women, but they do a profile of men who either will wear skirts or say they're feminists. So if you say you're a feminist, you don't need to wear a skirt. So for whatever it's worth, I've said I'm a feminist, and that part is in there. The next is in a poetry collection called The Sound of Poets Cooking. So I have a poem in there about artichokes, and there's a pretty good recipe, too. And that should be out next week or so. And then, oddly enough, in the fall, the North Carolina Arts Council and their cultural resources group has been putting out literary sort of pathways or roadmaps in which you can go to different parts of the state of North Carolina, and then you can read poems that sort of take place in those areas. And I have a poem in there about the creation of about two or three. It's a poem, so it has lots of subjects, but briefly, it's about the first shopping center in North Carolina, which was built on the Billy Graham homestead. And it also has to do with segregated water fountains.
Well, we have a lot to look for, Paul, and I look forward to having you back on the show as we perhaps can discuss your poetry in more detail. Paul, thank you much for joining us on the show.
Thanks a lot, David. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, same here. I will briefly mention that you can pick up the schedule for Hearsay Culture for the remaining shows in the quarter by going to hearsayculture.com. Among the guests coming up are Professors Eduardo Penalver of Cornell Law and Sonia Cotyell of Fordham Law discussing property outlaws, Professor Rob Frieden of Penn State's College of Communications discussing winning the Silicon Sweepstakes, Evgeny Morozov of Foreign Policy and author of How Dictators Learn to Stop Worrying and Love the Web, Associate Dean Michael Madison of University of Pittsburgh School of Law, and rounding out the quarter will be Professor Oded Shankar of Ohio State University Fisher's College of Business, author of Copycats. You can pick up the show live on KZSU-FM Stanford Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific Time, or you can get the show by going to our Stanford CIS's iTunes page, or by going to our website at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, and lastly by going to hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining me today on the show. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. I look forward to chatting with you next week. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great rest of the day.